Okay, can we make a start? Matthias, you're going to lead us through this?
Yes. So let's move to insurance agenda paper 5A and 5B. Agenda paper 5A gives you some background on a series of papers that is about to come on contracts where the policyholder participates in something. It kicks off a series of these types of contracts and that can be used as background information, and you can have a look at this paper whenever we come with another paper on participating contracts again. So let's directly move to agenda paper 5B, which is the issue that we want to discuss today, which is participating contracts with a contractual link to assets, a pool of contracts, or even the entire entity. We will be discussing other forms of participating contracts at a future meeting, such as universal life contracts that are sold in the United States that may have similar or the same features as some of the contracts we are talking about here. So to clarify, this is a subset of participating contracts that is distinct from others. There's some discretion involved in some of the other contracts, but this is here clearly if you have a link to the performance of assets, a pool of contracts, or the entire entity. Let's move to paragraph 6 on the and give some background on the participation features we talk about. They provide risk sharing in the development of linked items, where you have a contractual linkage to some assets. We looked at these contracts and identified similarities between these participating contracts and unit-linked contracts, and noticed that the main difference between these participating contracts and the unit links we talk about is the asymmetric risk sharing that you have that is usually imposed through the guarantees, through the minimum guarantee that you have in participating contracts. But still, unit linked gives you a direct pass-through from the performance of the linked items to the policyholder. Participating contracts usually have a lower percentage of what they are passing through to the policyholder. So there's a sliding scale between a straight unit link contract moving into some of these participation features with that contractual linkage. Some par contracts have an even broader link. They make you participate in the cost situation of the company or even the tax result, as some in continental Europe have. Let's move further to how the ED proposed that we should deal with unit-linked contracts and these participating contracts. You will see that and under paragraph 13 and following. When we looked at the ED proposed generally for participating contracts to identify the cash flows to the policyholders from that participation features in any case. And then we try to identify whether there's an accounting mismatch or not. For unit-linked, during the deliberations that led to the ED, we identified that there is a potential accounting mismatch stemming from treasury shares or from owner-occupied property, if that is included in the unit that it's linked to. And we provided consequential amendments to these other standards that these could be treated under the fair value option. So feedback to these consequential amendments was largely positive. People liked the fact that we are taking care of these accounting mismatches. However, they told us, by the way, you missed own debt insurance. So we're trying to get through a list of things that we could fix, but for example, own debt we missed. As a side note here, this is not an issue for our U.S. colleagues at the FASB because they have the investment company guidance that allows them to treat the variable contracts, how they call the unit link there, under the investment company guidance, all under fair value, which was the attempt in the ED, which we almost got there, but
missed some of it.
On participating contracts, people told us about potential accounting mismatches that can arise if you participate in assets that are not at fair value. Some have asked us to expand the unit-linked proposal to power contracts as well. So let's move to paragraph 24 and the following, where we discuss which accounting mismatches or how an accounting mismatch can arise for a participating contract. As said before, the proposal to independently estimate the cash flows should work fine if the assets and liabilities are at fair value. However, some of these assets or liabilities that you participate in are currently not measured at fair value, and the appendix provides you some standards where you can see you don't participate in. The example that you have in paragraph 25 illustrates how that accounting mismatch arises if you do not have a fair value measurement for the assets. And you can see there, in this example, you end up with an accounting mismatch of 180. So the staff looked at this issue, and we thought about, first of all, what our project axioms are. And one of the project axioms discussed in February was that an ideal measurement model would report all economic mismatches, including duration mismatches that exist, and would not cause any accounting mismatches. So based on that, we thought we might have caused an accounting mismatch here, and how could or should we treat that? And in a second step, what is the economic phenomenon that we actually want to depict here? And we think that participating contracts provide a risk sharing between the policyholder and the insurer, that if you independently measure it and have the assets or liabilities at one basis and the insurance contract at another basis, nobody really can see that linkage, that risk sharing between assets and liabilities. Consequently, we thought that the risk sharing is important and should be depicted. And therefore, the staff proposes to reduce the accounting mismatch by measuring the liability with the same measurement attribute as the underlying items that you are linked at. To summarize and move to paragraph 41, we think the more relevant phenomenon is the linkage and the risk sharing between the policyholder and the insurer rather than that independent measurement. In our view, that's easier to explain to users, and as a side note, the failure of market-consistent embedded value to explain how the economics behaved in 2008 and in the crisis may partially stem from that fact that it's really hard to measure independently the cash flows from those participation features and the inherent risk sharing between policyholders and the insurer. Some would argue that fair value is still preferable where it's available. The staff is not convinced, as we lay out in paragraph 43, that this should be the default solution if there's another solution available to avoid an accounting mismatch. Some would also ask what the liability really represents. And in paragraph 45, we are laying out that the liability should represent, under the staff proposal, the share in the performance of the linked items based on the IFRS surplus. Another point that is important to us and we laid it out in the example is that there's an asymmetry in that risk sharing that we talk about, usually because of the minimum guarantee that the insurer provides. The policyholder will participate in upside, but not in all the downside of the items that he's participating in. So there's an element of asymmetry that should be measured. Another point is, going down that route, it appeared logical to us that the performance of the contractually linked items, if that is measured and reported in OCI, the participation feature should actually follow that linkage. And I think to come to a close, before you kick off the discussion here for the boards is, based on all the analysis, we thought that unit-linked contracts should be treated the same way as everything else, which means the consequential amendments that we proposed in the AD should not be made, which also means in turn that the people that like the idea of having full fair value, including the fair value of treasury shares in the assets and liabilities, would not get that solution, but still have liabilities that matches the assets, but excluding recording treasury shares with zero and recording the liability for these treasury shares with zero. And with that, I would kick off the discussion for the boards.
Okay. Leslie, any comments from your team there? Sorry, Jennifer.
Any comments from the team?
No, I mean, I think we'll just chime in as the discussion progresses.
Okay, Leslie, do you want to kick off?
Sure. Any questions or comments from board members here?
I have a question.
Russ?
If I were to go to paragraph 6, and it talks about the scope of the paper and participating insurance contracts, it says in the second and third line, it says, participating insurance contract is an insurance contract which some or all of the benefits. So in a participating contract where some of the benefits are tied to an asset and some aren't, is your staff recommendation proposing that the entire insurance liability be based on the assets it's linked to or only the portion? And if it's only the portion, does that mean there are different measurement attributes for the same contract? I understand it for all, but I'm confused in how it operates for when some of it participates.
It is some. That may be a mixed measurement. That is a mixed measurement attribute. That is true. So you have the insurance part of the liability, and you measure depending on the assets what these assets are measured at.
In essence, I treat it as two different insurance contracts.
So essentially, this is getting at those types of contracts that have participating features to them. So you still have the underlying insurance that has the building blocks, or it will be the building blocks for all of these types of contracts. It would be the building blocks. But then there's some sort of participation that you're going to get some sort of return that's contractually linked. So, for example, there's certain contracts in parts of the world and also in the U.S. where you're sharing, and especially for like mutual company contracts or some of the stock life companies, you're sharing in that block of business. So the policyholder is going to get, in that case, 90% of the performance will go to this participating policyholder liability. The other 10% is available to the shareholders. Now, that's just one example. There's other examples out there. So you're getting the performance of the of what's this is your liability, your dividend, your features being linked to. You're getting some of that performance.
But in essence, the way I would measure that insurance liability is I would bifurcate that. I would measure the participating amount under your proposal, under your recommendation, which is linked to the asset, and I'd measure the insurance component under the building blocks. Right? Is that the
Right.
way to think about it? Basically,
Correct.
I bifurcated the contract.
And
Correct.
Even within that bifurcation, you could have a mixed attribute because not all the assets that deliver the pay are going to be under. They could be under multiple measurement attributes.
So I hadn't thought of that.
Exactly.
You're right.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Well, on that point, if I understand the staff recommendation in paragraph 45, it is to measure the liability using whatever measurement attribute applies to the asset to which the contract is linked. And if I understand that correctly, I don't understand why that is an appropriate proxy, if you will, for a current measure of the liability in cases where the amount that would potentially be payable to the policy holder is, let's say, a change in the value of the asset to which it is linked, but the current accounting guidance for that asset is not a current measure. So if I have this right, if I'm understanding it correctly, I think we might have this backwards. In other words, I think that the liability should be a current estimate of the amount that would have to be paid to the policyholder. And if we have a mismatch here, I would adjust the accounting for the asset. I would not have the current accounting method, which may have nothing to do with current values, drive the accounting for the liability.
And I guess one point to that, that would be one alternative, and that is a solution that is possible. That would ultimately mean that some insurance contracts or some insurers would have a full fair value balance sheet that would include deferred tax assets, that would include other liabilities, owner-occupied properties, anything else that you don't have at a fair value. In order to eliminate all the accounting mismatches that you have, you would need to have a full fair value balance sheet, if that's what you want. But that would be one solution, yeah.
Well, when you say a full fair value balance sheet, I guess to the extent that all of your policies are linked to your assets.
Yeah. But to the extent that all of your assets are linked to
Right.
Fairly. And all of your liabilities have to do with performance of assets and not some payment for insured events.
No, it's performance of the surplus.
Right.
It's not performance of the assets. What Matthias is describing is when the liability is linked to the surplus.
Oh, I see. I understand.
And therefore, he's saying, well, to get the surplus, you need the fair value.
It would be the realization of the change in those assets. So it would be the realization, which is what affects the surplus in some of the situations. So that's why what's affecting the surplus and the change in sometimes, or not the change in surplus, sometimes that is assets that are at an amortized cost basis, sometimes it's assets that are at fair value, sometimes it's assets that are have the change in through fair value through the income statement, other times it has assets change in as fair value through OCI, and so it's what's impacting, at the end of the day, the performance.
Right. I don't have this concern when the amount that's been promised to the policyholder is actually based on whatever the gap representation is. I'm concerned about the cases where whatever's been promised to the policyholder has nothing to do with the current accounting for the asset.
How often does that occur? That's good. Good question.
Well,
the
examples that the staff has used are treasury shares and owner-occupied property.
And deferred tax.
Let's not talk about the surplus yet. Let's just talk about when the policyholder payment is bogeyed off of real estate owned or owner-occupied property. Right? The amount you're getting is on the ultimate realization of the owner-occupied property, not on what GAAP says. Is that right?
Yep.
I think the ones that I'm most familiar with, and Matthias can also chime in, is where it's based on the performance of that, what has happened so far. So it wouldn't be off of if you're carrying a real estate at amortized cost and the fair value of that is double that amortized cost that I'm going to pay out to my policyholder. I haven't seen a contract that says what I'm going to dividend you is based on the fair value of the real estate that I haven't even yet recognized. What I've typically seen is it's based on the results through the income statement and what's or the results of the movement, whether it be through the income statement or OCI, that would be based off of. So it wouldn't get into this, but there could be situations out there. I don't know, Matthias, if you know of other situations where the participating feature would be off of some value that's not reflected in the income in the balance sheet.
I think to start with, usually these participation features are measured on a completely different measurement basis than IFRS, GAAP, or something else. The point really is that you could think about it a little bit like deferred taxes, where you have something different in your statutory and here in your tax returns versus what you have in IFRS or US GAAP. And under tax, you need to identify what these differences are, and these are temporary or timing differences, and see when they will materialize and will go to the policyholders. So the measurement basis is somewhat relevant, but it really the statutory or the way that the policyholder participation is actually distributed is usually not GAAP or IFRS. It is some statutory number.
And it's the amount that's actually reflected in the financial statements of those statutory, in the financial statements on a statutory basis. Hence, it has already formed. And what this tries to get at is, if on a statutory basis I have one accounting, when I bring it over to U.S. GAAP or to IFRS, because we've got different accounting, I'm now, if my asset is marked at amortized cost on a stat basis, it's at fair value through OCI on a GAAP basis. Because I've increased that asset on the GAAP basis, my surplus has increased. However, that amount of surplus that has increased can't all be available to the shareholder, because part of that has to be set aside to the policyholder. So it's remeasuring it. It's the time difference to how I've recorded it on GAAP. And now what I would say, calling, you know, setting it aside for the policyholder, since that's really a distribution to them.
Do you, in order to fulfill your obligation to the policyholder on the liquidity event, do they generally sell the asset? The reason I ask is because if you drive the obligation based on the measurement of the asset, and let's suppose the measurement of the asset is at cost, if you pay out on the obligation and you don't sell the asset, you're going to have a loss at that point.
Exactly. There's a liquidity call as well that hasn't been reflected.
Yes, you're right. That's why I initially, when I first read it, I had the same philosophy as Leslie, that you would measure the liability about what your potential cash outflow will be, and if we have an accounting mismatch that we don't believe results in an economic mismatch, we should deal with that and how we want to measure the assets.
And this is if a policyholder called up tomorrow and said, I want to cash out on my liability or whatever that amount is. It is based on what the company has already, I guess you'd say, realized, although it could have been realized through the income statement or realized through OCI, not on some other value. Now, do they have to sell that asset? I've never seen where they've had to sell that asset.
Okay, but earlier you said realized for statutory. So is it statutory or GAAP?
So most of the times, at least in my experience here in the U.S. and in some of these situations, it is based on the statutory value. But because your statutory value in your GAAP financial statements, you have a different value. So if I based it just on my statutory value, the concern is if you don't move those assets to what it is recorded on a GAAP basis, you will be showing your equity that's available to shareholders that is too high.
So, but if the statutory basis is amortized cost,
yes,
then they're just going to get their portion of that asset at amortized cost.
They would get their at amortized cost. I mean, usually, again, I've seen it where it's more on the performance of the block of business or the performance, so you do have assets and liabilities, there are assets and liabilities moving, and it either goes through the income statement or OCI, but it hits surplus, as Mark was indicating before. Yes, that is the amount you would get. The concern and the reason for this paper is to say, if you were to just take that amount on the statutory basis, there's a big concern there that's going to be a lower amount that's going to be set aside for that's going to be part of my dividend and part of my insurance contract liability, since on the IFRS or GAAP basis, I've already marked that asset up. And so by marking that asset up, I've increased my surplus. That full amount of that increase in surplus is not necessarily available to the shareholders, because that increase in surplus, part of that has to be set aside for the dividend to my policyholders. And so that's where Matthias said it's similar to deferred taxes in the insurance world. We base our taxes, what we pay for taxes is based off the statutory, but I've got this timing difference that I have to reflect. And that's an analogy that's being used here somewhat loosely of why we have to make that adjustment.
How big of a problem is this, though? Because why would I, if I'm entering in this contract, negotiate to say that I want a return based on a statutory amortized cost rather than a fair value, because then I don't get to participate in any subsequent change in those underlying assets as a policyholder? So
it's because, so in a lot of times in the insurance world, the reserves and everything else is just, it's on a statutory basis, and so it's the performance of that on a statutory basis. That's how most of these types of contracts are written, at least throughout the world, to our knowledge. It's not based on, because I think the situation that Leslie and others were bringing up of where it's based on the fair value of the real estate, or if I didn't have that, that would then potentially be more fall into a derivative category than into the other category.
So one of the specific examples that you used, that the staff used in the memo, was Treasury shares. So are you saying that there is a different representation of Treasury shares in statutory reports than in U.S. GAAP, or than in GAAP?
And Matthias, maybe you want to address the Treasury shares?
I guess that it depends on the participation system. That is one piece, but I think that is one part of the issue that we have, that there's a difference between statutory and what we have in IFRS. The other part of the issue is if you really try to independently measure the cash outflows, you would have to estimate what your statutory return for the next, for example, 30 years might be, and take that into account to get to your ultimate cash outflows. And that is actually okay if you measure everything at fair value. You could get there. However, we don't measure everything at fair value in the balance sheet as of now. I think Peter wanted to say
something. Yeah, can I just pick up on Tom's question as well, which is why would somebody buy a contract with this participation feature? If you contrast it with a unit-linked or variable contract, that is basically like a mutual fund. All the performance flows through to the policyholders directly. In the participating contracts, what's going on is a risk-sharing both among the policyholders but also among different generations of policyholders. And so the proposition they're buying is that they get a smooth return over time. They lose some of the peaks and troughs.
Pressure.
Yeah, but then we're going to introduce an accounting that introduces the peaks and troughs, right? Because you're going to change the accounting for the asset that's at amortized cost on the balance sheet to reflect what's in the statutory reports.
No, I'm sorry.
The other way.
It's the other way.
I see.
Yeah. It's trying to make sure that the equity at the end of the day is going to be appropriate.
I struggle with this one. It seems to me that the economics is that if the liability outflow is directly tied to the asset return, fair value for the asset is the most relevant information that you could have, and that's kind of where we were in the ED, was fix the assets. I think the tension point is the point that we were talking about earlier, is when it's not just directly related to the asset. It's related to sort of the surplus and the return on the whole line of business. And I think some of this is also going to be driven off of in different states with different state regulations, the kind of things that are offered are going to be different by law, and it might be driven off of statutory numbers. So I don't know whether, you know, what we do for separate accounts here, I think, is fair value all the assets. But these, how does that tie into this?
Yeah. I mean, here, obviously, the separate accounts, because that is an investment company, have a separate account, you have an investment company, and you're actually registered with the SEC and file all your product filings. So that follows investment company guidance, and that is what gets passed through to the policy.
So it seems to me that, I almost would like I almost think about it differently. It's tied directly to if the participating contract, insurance contract, is tied to the asset, I might think about it as trying to change the asset. But for practical reasons, I can understand the staff's recommendation when it's tied to the overall surplus.
But why do we need a special principle when it's tied to the overall surplus? You should measure the liability based on your current estimate of what the payout would be based on that formula. I don't understand why we need a separate approach to this.
Well, let's put it in a broader context. The whole insurance accounting model, not just for these sorts of contracts, are one in which we have a liability measurement at one measurement attribute, and it's funded with assets. It would seem to me that if we want to work at this surplus being right, it isn't limited to just these contracts. We'd have to think about it more holistically. why are we working so hard at it for these contracts if we're not going to do the measurement of trying to get the shareholders' equity right in the whole model for all contracts on asset and liabilities?
Yeah. And this is really, I mean, the way I would look at this is more the dividend. This is more the dividend, not the liability itself. And it goes back to Russell. This is the dividend, that the additional amount that I'm going to pay you out, and what is that based on? And that so to your point, it's trying to focus on what is the amount that I need to put up today for a dividend I'm going to pay you out. Sometimes these dividends aren't paid out for many, many, many years, 50, 60 years, until the very end when there's the last policyholder left and they die, and you petition to say, now I would like to release those funds to go to my shareholders. I mean, that sort of, so sometimes these liabilities are out there for a long time. Sometimes they are paid out, but it's a dividend that we're trying to calculate here.
But I don't understand.
I think the dividend's
not. That's added to consideration. I mean, if you're supposed to be measuring your liability based upon what you expect to happen, et cetera, I would think that would take care of it.
Right. You consider all the information you have available to you about what the surplus reported this period will be.
And then you're saying just measure that liability based on that and don't worry about the funding side of it or the potential for an accounting mismatch.
It may or may not relate to IFRS or U.S. GAAP from what I'm hearing. I mean, right? Stat differs in many respects. So,
and the only reason for adjusting it is because it's based on the performance and because those assets are the exact same assets on a GAAP or stat basis. And so the performance, I've already marked them up on the GAAP basis, those exact same assets. And so while I might pay out something on the statutory value, because I've marked it on my GAAP, and because that the whole thing gets to getting my equity right. So the fear is that the equity would be too high if I don't convert it over, and therefore some of that equity should be set aside as part of the liability to the policyholder.
Okay.
Could I have a go at this one, perhaps? Let me take it in a couple of stages. First of all, on the measurement attribute question. So the overall model says that what we're trying to do is measure the cash flows that are going to go to the policyholder. So we set up our building blocks, and some of the cash flows are independent of the underlying assets, and so we do those using the building blocks. There's no great difficulty. We do current estimates of all the scenarios and so on. But some of the cash flows depend on the underlying assets, and they depend directly on the underlying assets. And in a sense, what's going on there, if you look through to it, it's almost the same as if instead of giving the policyholder a cash payment, you're actually giving them a share in the underlying assets. It's almost as if you're distributing the underlying assets to them. Now, it doesn't actually happen like that. You don't actually hand over the share certificates or what have you. But economically, the effect is the same as if you're handing over the underlying assets or an interest in them, at least. Now, that wouldn't be a problem if the underlying assets were at fair value, because then the whole thing would be in balance on the asset side and the liability side, and that there would be no mismatches. But there might be two sets of circumstances when that's not the case. And if you look at paragraph 43, where there's a list of some of the examples, the things in A and B are really cases where it seems rather unlikely that in this project we'd actually get those assets to fair value. Deferred tax, for example, Matthias keeps mentioning that, and that's not just a nervous tick, I think. It is actually a real-life case that you have that. I don't think we're going to get deferred tax at fair value in this project. you never know. So there'd be some cases where we may not be able to resolve the mismatch on the asset side. And it doesn't really much matter for the cash flows that do flow through directly from the assets to the liabilities, whether we have them both on a fair value basis, both on a current basis, or both on some other basis, provided they're the same. The second case is where the insurer could, if it chose, eliminate the assets by carrying the mismatch by carrying the assets at fair value, but may choose not to. And probably the most significant example I'm thinking of there is where amortized costs would be the default option under IFRS 9, for example, but where the fair value option would be available, and so they could choose to carry the assets at fair value. And I think it's worth thinking about that in the two stages. One is the unavoidable or the mismatches that seem likely to be unavoidable if we stick with a purely current measurement on the liability side. And then secondly, the ones that the insurer could choose to avoid if it wants to. Now, why would you want to choose to deal with the second case? And let me try and explain that by going back to the example in paragraph, so after paragraph 25. What we've got there, we've said that we've got the liability that's made up of three components. And if you diagram this out, you could actually show that the amount that goes to the policyholders in aggregate really behaves economically as if it's the sum of three different components. The first component, if you look at the three bullets that are towards the bottom of the example, the first bullet is the guaranteed amount of 1,000. The second bullet is 90% of the fair value of the assets. And the third bullet is the guarantee, which is a bit like a put option. It's a bit like a put option for the policyholders to put their 90% interest in the assets back for a fixed payment. Now, let's look at those three components separately. The 1,000 guaranteed amount, we could have that at fair value, we could have that at current. That would behave differently depending on which way we did that. The guarantee, the third bullet, we said that we want to measure that on a current basis regardless. That's picking up the asymmetric risk sharing that Matthias was talking about. And then the third piece is the 90% interest in the shares. That middle piece, the 90%, that's the piece that doesn't really much matter whether you've chosen the fair value route or the cost route in a way, because it'll be the same on both sides of the balance sheet. What matters is the thousand guaranteed amount that's in there, and if you diagrammed out the returns to the shareholders, what they would have opposite that £1,000 guarantee, the thousand amount guaranteed, is a 10% interest in the underlying assets, and so there's a genuine economic mismatch there, which is the thousand fixed payment versus 10% interest in the assets. Now, why might you want to deal with that? I mean, clearly, if you're looking at full economic value, you might say, well, that's a real economic mismatch. Show it in the financial statements. I think one argument people will put up is that people have the option of carrying, or not just an option, but in IFRS 9, it's actually the default treatment of carrying particular assets on an amortized cost basis. And in a sense, by going down the route that says you'll measure all these three components on a current basis, in a sense you're depriving them of the option and forcing them to elect the fair value option for the underlying assets there. So to summarise, I think what's at stake here is really two different sets of issues. The first set of issues is, given that it seems unlikely we'll be able to eliminate all the accounting mismatches, do we want to set up a treatment that eliminates it on the liability side rather than leaving them unaddressed? And then secondly, do you want to address the case where the insurer could avoid the mismatch if it chose the fair value option, but in a sense you're forcing them to choose the fair value option rather than leaving the choice with them?
Right. Just to put a fine point on that, Peter, in that example, if we were to accept the staff recommendation and the assets held by the insurance company were carried at amortized cost, the entity would report the liability at 1,000, not at 1185, which is the current estimate of the amount they owe.
Yeah, and it would have the 5. It would have the 5 in there as well for the guarantee, so it would be 1,005.
Why don't we hand over to the ISB and see what kind of comments and questions you have.
David, can I ask a question on that exact point?
Go ahead, Julie.
Right, so Peter, let's say exactly the example on in paragraph 25. So you said 1,185 should be recognized as it should be the amount of the liability. Because the if we look at the paragraph 49, the question 1, the question 1 is the fulfillment cash flows should include the cash flows expected to result from the policyholder participation on the same basis as the measurement of the underlying items the policyholder participate in. So in that case, just based on the amortized cost of 1,000 and plus the 20% of 200 plus 5, and it's a 1,185. So that is a measurement of the insurance liability in the case of the participation feature. Is that true?
Let me try and explain it, and I'll ask Matthias to audit my explanation as I go along. There are basically two routes. The route that says you have the assets at fair value will have the assets in at 1,200 and will have the liability in at 1,185 and you'll have equity of 15. If you go down the cost route, you'll have the assets in there at 1,000 and you'll have the liability in there at 1,005, which is made up of the 1,000 cost basis and the 5 for the guarantee. Now that difference of 20 between the two routes is the source of the is the economic mismatch that will be the source of volatility if you're in the current approach. The 20 comes from the fact that you've accumulated a surplus of 20 or at least 200 and the shareholder share is 20. And obviously that 20 will move over time as the underlying assets move. So if you looked at it on day one, that 20 wouldn't have been there. It's built up over time, and it's subject to some volatility, of course, as markets change. Matthias, did I get that right?
But I'm waiting for the Matthias the response reply.
Okay. Yes. Sorry. Yeah, you couldn't see me. You couldn't see me nodding. Sorry. Yes. Yes.
You can see him nodding.
But say, still, I have a trouble to understand the meaning. Say, in the paragraph 49, question one says, on the same basis as the measurement of the underlying items.
So what that means, Tatsumi, is that if the underlying items is measured at book value, in this case at 1,000, you would measure the liability at the 1,005, because that's the same basis, whereas if it was at fair value of 1,200, the same basis would be the 1,185.
But my trouble with this point is if it has a fair value of 1,200, inevitably, the asset. If the entity will sell the asset, they can achieve the 1,200. So why we have to recognize as based on amortized cost? That is I do not understand, because the amortized cost does not relate to the future cash flows. It seems to me.
And that goes back to what Peter was saying, Tatsumi, was that in IFRS 9, the default option is amortized cost. So if you insist that it goes to fair value, you effectively deprive insurers of that option. And the second point, which was for those that you can't or we're unlikely ever to require fair value measurement for, so things like the deferred tax assets, then it will always be at some kind of book value. It won't be at fair value. And so you would always have the mismatch.
Okay, so but my trouble is participation feature is it depends on the jurisdiction, but in most cases when it becomes realized gains, it should be it could be distributed to the policyholder. In that case, I think that the amortized cost it doesn't matter, but say realized gains and losses, that means maybe fair value could have a sort of appropriate indication, it seems to me. So I have a trouble with the question of one of the paragraph 49.
Maybe one response to that to me. If you are based on a realized basis, then you actually have to sell that asset, and that asset will then flow, the performance of that asset will flow through the statement, and so will, following that, the policyholder participation. It will be, you realize that gain if you are an amortized cost or at another cost basis, not focused on financial instruments, and that would increase your liability at the same time. You're linked between how the performance developed in your financials, the linked assets, and the liability. At the same time, when the performance happens, it will increase.
Okay, so anyway, I stop here, but in case of the old asset is measured at fair value, like a unit link, so in that case, I agree with the measurement basis, but it could be amortized cost. I think it's not reflection of the participating feature, it seems to me.
But I guess that, to me, the premise behind all this is that if what you're doing is effectively handing over the asset, as long as you measure the asset and the obligation to hand it over at the same amount, then you're reflecting some kind of economic reality.
Yeah.
Warren?
Yeah, I've got a few things to say, but just on that point, I think that's true, Andrea, but I think we may need to have some, if we go down this path, we may need to have some disclosures there, because those assets, those financial assets, will be requiring disclosure. We do require disclosure of fair value, and there's a claim against that unrecorded fair value, and it might be potentially misleading if we don't make that clear. I prefer the ED approach, and I have the same concerns that Leslie's expressed and Tatsumi, because I think the building block approach does give you, in those circumstances, the best estimate of those future cash flows. I might be able to live with this somewhat reluctantly, because I think these contracts are structured in a particular way with this contractual link, and there are different types of contracts, and I think it becomes difficult when you move away from specific assets in particular. I take your point that the limitations of our existing accounting model create some problems in terms of accounting mismatches. I think there are reasons why we might seriously consider moving away from a strict application of the building block approach. Having said that, I don't see why, if we went down this path, we wouldn't still want to proceed with the proposals in the exposure draft in terms of owner-occupied property and treasury shares. Because if, let's say in the case of unit-linked contracts, a company wants to be able to have a reflection of that liability that's consistent with the building blocks approach, why would we preclude them from doing that? So I don't think they're incompatible, to be quite honest, and I'd like to proceed with that, irrespective of whether we decide to adopt this approach or not.
Yeah, could I just make comments on that as well? Because I think, particularly for the unit-linked contracts, the insurer is going to be reporting the fair value information to the policyholders anyway. I mean, it's just the natural way for them to be reporting. So it's probably quite easy for them. The easiest thing for them to do is to have all the assets of fair value in that case.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of the complications we're talking about are when you move away from the unit links into the participating contracts.
Are you agreeing with me?
Probably.
I thought you were.
One point, Warren, and you said that we're moving away from the building block approach. I don't think we see it as an alternative approach. We're just, to changing what cash flows, what discount. We've already done it for the discount rate. You've already agreed that with the participating contracts, you reflect that participation in the discount rate. This is now talking about the cash flows part of the approach. You're reflecting the participating in the cash flows as well.
Yes, but the measure of those cash flows.
The measure is not a current measure, but it's still the building block approach. Yeah.
It's not a complete application of the building block approach. Yes, it reflects an expected value, but limited by the measurement of those assets under whatever gap you're applying.
Well, it's current in the sense that it's looking at the assets that you currently have to deliver. It's just that the assets you currently have to deliver are measured on a basis that isn't itself.
I know.
Warren, just
don't convince me it's consistent with the building block approach.
It's only a very small tweak.
You said we should go to a sort of fair value where you can fair value the assets. Now, are you going to try and sort of say, well, you can revalue properties? No, that's not the case in the United States, but you certainly can under our gap. Not a lot of people do it, but you can do it. Are you going to see which ones would be affected?
Just what we had in the ED, David, where we said that in the case of owner-occupied property, you can't get fair value under IS40, but in the case of unit-linked contracts, the backing assets may comprise owner-occupied property, and currently our literature precludes fair value for those. And so we said in the ED, you know, we'll make an allowance for those to be at fair value. And also quite often they, particularly in jurisdictions where you've got a smaller capital market, when you replicate that index, often you find that your own shares are part of that index, and under our literature you can't record those as an asset. And so what we said was we'll allow you to recognise those as an asset at fair value, as an exception to our normal literature. Only in those two cases.
You said allow, not require.
Allow, yeah, if they want to do it. And I think, for example, in Australia, I know they would want to record all assets that were backing those policies to the extent they could at fair value. Now, if something, deferred taxes in there, well, I don't think it would be in a unit-linked case, but to the extent that they had their own shares as assets backing the unit-linked policies and owner-occupied property, the ED said we'll allow you to use fair value because that gives you a more complete representation of the insurance contract liability.
And if they didn't want to, you'd accept the recommendation here?
No, I said I might be able to live. This is a different issue, David. I might be able to live with this recommendation staff's put up.
Just so that I can confirm what I understand, if we had the recommendation in place, if you voted on it and agreed it, would you then allow them as an option? So those people, those unit-linked ones could do it either at fair value or at the... it would be an option.
Sure. And that's what we had in the ED.
Yeah.
Could I just clarify the owner-occupied point, because you misspoke slightly, Warren? We don't have an issue in IFRS for investment property because people have the option to use the fair value model there. The difficulty is for owner-occupied property because under IS16 there isn't a fair value option. There is the revaluation model, but then the revaluations are going through OCI. They're not going through profit or loss.
Yeah, true.
Elka, and then I've got PK, John.
And David, I have another question.
Okay, you have to wait, Tatsumi, though. Elka?
Okay, I think, first of all, Warren, we once in a while agree and once in a while we disagree. I think we are not deviating, at least not substantially deviating, from the building block approach. It's just the question how I measure the cash flow part of it, and that needs to be consistent with the promise to the contractual obligation to the to the policyholder. I would probably agree with you that for unit-linked contracts, allowing companies to fair value any assets back the contracts solved the problem. But what we heard was a bit, and that is what concerns me a bit, and what about this and what about that? Because there is variety what is potentially backing your contract, and you might get into endless debate, have you missed something? What I like about the staff proposal is, considering that unit-linked and participating contracts are all the same in my policyholder participating either in specific assets or in the overall performance of part of or the entire company, in moving away from adjusting the asset valuation and saying I need to faithfully reflect it on the liability side is the conceptually probably sounder answer, because it gives me the chance to say in different ideas, I've got a principle and I'm not looking and picking out and saying I need to adjust this asset, I need to adjust that asset, and if we come up with something else, you need to have a consequential amendment. I agree that you need a lot of disclosure around it, because you should not lose out the information that if assets that are on amortized cost get sold over time, that part of that might have to flow through the policyholder and doesn't get depicted to the shareholders.
Okay, PK.
I want to ask two or three questions, Matthias, and you and I spoke about it, but let us assume you know where I stand. I cannot understand what that liability amount represents, but I understand why you came to that conclusion, and I think you are caught between a rock and a hard place, and you definitely wanted to do something without tampering too much in other literature. So I respect your thought process on that point of view. I want to ask you a question. If you're doing the asset at its relevant value, measurement value, book value, amortized cost, whatever it is, suppose I have a owner-occupied, just to take an example, but as a participating shareholder or participating insurance holder, I get at the then fair value that portion of it. My owner-occupied property is at book value. Mm-hmm. But when the participating contract is based on the fair value, which includes the owner-occupied, but I don't understand how your accounting works when I come to pay off the liability. I got to pay it off at the then fair value of the owner-occupied property. And if you don't adjust the asset value, you will have a loss without a corresponding gain on the books. I don't think that's a good representation of the economics of the transaction, what you're suggesting if you fast forward. So that's something we need to think through. If you, what you're suggesting, that will create a problems there. The second thing, just to change the tracks, because I agree with a lot of people that the liability amount that we have does not really represent the amount that we need to pay as a future cash flows. I want to change the tracks and ask you a question on this asymmetric risk, and I think Peter correctly said, in my way, this is nothing but a written put option that you have given. Anytime you have to value a written put option, other than the time value portion of it, isn't it also includes the underlying fair values to understand whether the written put option is in above money, below the money, and all. So somehow the fair value calculation may not be so rigorous, I don't know, I'm not an evaluation expert, but the written put option portion somehow brings in the fair value notion. And how do you get around doing for one and not doing for other aspect of it? And the example that you have in paragraph 25.1005, mm-hmm. It's like you correctly accepted in the beginning, it's a mixed model. Mm-hmm. I just don't get it. And also, own credit comes into picture in a written put option. And how do you, again, take this whole thing into consideration? Because the own credit also comes into picture here. So I think you're trying to find a problem solution which is fair, but I don't know whether we got there. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Let me start off with the owner-occupied property. The problem is if you pay out and the linkage is to the owner-occupied property's performance. That is usually the case if you are linked to the entire surplus of the company, because the owner-occupied property you will keep. It will stay in there.
Exactly.
And in these cases, statutory will usually lead you not to pay out the fair value of that, but the cost performance there. So there's nothing that you pay above it.
Above your book value.
Above the book value, yes. So that's probably one of these. If you really go down the path of par, that at the end of the day, it will be back the book value, so there's no change in performance in here.
But that is only because some statutory authority will make you do that. But if it is not, then you have trouble. Your model is relying on the fact that the statutory authority will ask you to pay out at book value. But if it is not based at the book value and it is indexed to the then current value of the owner-occupied property, then you will have a loss.
It might make sense that we differentiate between some of these, because in some of those situations, if I'm paying out on the performance of something, if I was to fair value that, if somebody was to die tomorrow, they're going to get, based on what I was carrying it at on my statutory basis, they're going to get that piece tomorrow. So if I had fair valued it, they're not going to get that full fair value. If you go ahead and sell that asset in the future and that runs through, whoever's your policyholders will get that piece of it. And so it comes back to, I think, that there's different types. And what Matthias and I what we're trying to say is some of these other examples might be clouding the issue of the abundance of what this is trying to get at, which is where Matthias is saying that it's based on the statutory value. If someone dies tomorrow, they're going to get whatever performance has already ran through.
Steve, you want to come in?
Yeah. I don't think it matters whether it's statutory value or fair value. If you cash out at fair value, sure, you get your share of the fair value of whatever the portfolio is, but it's paid to you in cash, and that cash diminishes the assets which are available. So liability goes down by whatever's paid, assets go down by whatever's paid. Of course, if you sell the property to get the cash to pay the policyholder, well, then the assets go up anyway because you realize the property and you recognize the gain.
I don't think I'm talking about cash flow. I'm talking about pure income statement. Simple example.
I'm talking about income statements as
simple
well.
Simple example.
And there's no income statement effect.
Simple example. The owner-occupied property is at $100.
Yeah.
The fair value became $200. Simplicity. And you are the only guy with a participating contract.
Right.
Okay? The value went up to 200. You get 90% of the increase. I'm just making it up. Stay with me. So it goes up to 200. And you need to pay a liability. I need to pay you at $190 right now because guaranteed amount is 100. I pay 90% of it, $190. So my carrying value of the liability is at 100 according to Matthias' accounting. So I need to cut a check to you at 190. Debit liability 100, debit income statement 90, credit cash 190. So the 90 is a loss, but the asset stayed at 100, it doesn't go up to 100, 200. So you will have a mismatch until you sell this asset, which could be 20 years from now or 50 years from now.
But the property is no longer an asset which is backing that participating obligation.
But on that day, unless you increase it to 190, you will have an income statement impact. I can go to Matt on this.
Try to what?
I can go to Matt. I can fight with anyone on this entry.
your journal is
taken offline.
So if you have an asset liability mismatch like that, where you don't need to update it, you will always have this mismatch.
This assumes that this is a realistic example that you've got the asset at now cost or amortized cost, and that the policyholder participation is at fair value. But PK, it's normally the other way around. You have the asset in IFRS or use GAAP at now whatever basis, the policyholder participation is normally based on statutory accounting. To take the U.S. phrase, on German GAAP accounting in our country and other GAAPs, which are normally by far more cost-based. But I agree, the very moment you're making up your example, you would cause a significant issue to the company, and Matthias would probably be the first one to say that if this is the case, I have to reflect it in my cash outflows to the policyholder, because that's what I have to pay to the policyholder.
What I'm trying to say is that we are all hiding behind the statutory thing, and which I don't know it is the same across all the regimes. All I'm trying to say is that we are trying to do it. You might be working from a German's point of view. Somebody might be working from a U.S. point of view. I come from No Man Island, and I don't have a statutory thing. So how do you do that? I'm just trying to say this will have implications we need to think through.
I think the principle should be the same, but I think we should take the double entries offline and circle back to you on that one.
Well, let me just say that the company will use my fair value option for its owner-occupied property.
Speaking of fair value option,
he didn't answer all the questions, though.
It seems to me that the argument that we're denying someone amortized cost, that's kind of weak. The fair value option was put in place so that if something was at fair value and something was at cost, you'd put them both at fair value. Not the other way around, we put them both at cost. And we've argued this fulfillment value is the way to measure insurance liabilities, and now we seem to be moving away from that. So it just seems to me we ought to be valuing the liability. I was a bit concerned about how this would work if we didn't. And PK used the example of property. I wasn't sure how that would work, but it seemed to me in the case of a treasury bond, or I'm sorry, a treasury stock, you could see the values. I could see where a entity might be required to pay on that basis ahead of having sold the shares. But having done that, or if you did that and incurred the loss, it would seem to me to eliminate the mismatch, you would want to value those shares, and you're doing this to avoid having to do that. I didn't agree with what we had in the ED. It seemed to me if a bank indexed its debt to its stock, we'd say you have a derivative, and we wouldn't care whether you had treasury shares or not. So it just seems like we're working overtime to get rid of mismatches. I'm less concerned about the property under 16. If I got the measurement of the asset wrong, I got the measurement of the liability wrong. If I got them right, it doesn't matter. They're both going to offset. But I'd start with measuring the liability. I'm really troubled with kind of another mixed something in that liability measurement. And as I said, I don't like what we're doing in the ED, but you guys have voted on that. As much as I hate it, I prefer that. I also was a bit confused by some of the FASB discussion where it seemed that if this thing was run through P&L, I thought there was no question about there's an obligation if you have to pay it and you recognize it. There wasn't an issue about something else there. This is only an issue when it's indexed to an asset and the asset's not recognized at the same measure.
Yeah, yeah. John, can I just make sure I understood what you said there? You're saying where, and I think this is what Peter said earlier. No, it wasn't clear. You know, where you have the option to use the fair value option, you would say that you should actually measure the liability at the fair value amount if it's related to the value of the asset, obviously. You're there. Now, what did you say about properties? I didn't quite get what you said about properties.
I would start out, I'd measure the I wouldn't tinker with the measurement of the liability for the mismatch, okay? And my point on the fair value option was we wouldn't, if this was financial, we wouldn't say the things at fair value put it at amortized cost because I'm denying the thing that amortized cost to be at amortized cost.
But they're not saying that. It's the other way around. But what would you do about a property?
I'll get into that, though. But it seemed to me that if I start out with I'm going to measure the liability and I want to eliminate the mismatch on the property because that's at cost, to the extent that we don't use fair value because it's difficult to measure, we don't know what it is, so it could be between 80 and 100. I pick 80, so that's what I picked for the asset. I'm picking the same for the liability. I'm in sync.
And is 80 cost?
Yeah. No, I'm marking my property to 80, which I think is the fair value. And so whatever the difference between cost and that 80, that increment, say it was at my books at 60, so now I'm putting it on at 80, adding the 20, I'm going to do the same on the liability. If my friend over here decides that it's really 90, well, he's going to do 30 and 30. So I'm either way, I'm in balance on what I do. I'm less concerned that there's going to be a big problem here because the two have to offset.
That's true for the unit link case. It's not true for the participating case, though, because the policyholders don't have 100% economic interest in it.
So I get 80% of 80. Isn't it going to be the same number on both sides?
No, because you'll have 80 on one side and 64 on the other side, and PK will have 90 on one side and 72 on the other side. Yeah.
But there'll be 16 will go through equity.
That 18 goes through equity holders' income statement.
And what do you do, John, about these countries that tell us they can't value, which is why in IAS 40 we have the option? They can't value the properties.
I don't like Warren's solution of an option to do the right thing when most people say they can't do the right thing. It just seems to me it's an option. And I'm also less concerned than perhaps most of you at this table about getting rid of a mismatch because it's a mismatch.
But David, the question is that how do you value the option? How do you value the put option if you don't know the fair values? How do you value that? That's a question. I don't know the answer to that. So that incorporates the fair values. Even those countries which cannot, don't want to do it under IAS 40, they have to account for the put option.
And again, I guess this is not a question of you could or could not do fair valuing and you could or could not measure the cash flows. This is really a question of do we want to live with accounting mismatches that we have through our model or don't we want to live with them? If we want to live with these accounting mismatches, then call
Didn't
it a day.
Anybody in the past.
And it is just an axiom that the boards have agreed on in February that an ideal measurement model excludes accounting mismatch. I'm not talking about the economic mismatch, accounting mismatches. And it seems a little awkward that I always come back with the deferred tax assets, but it is an example. If we really want to fair value deferred taxes, that would be a way to do it. And John, the way that you described it just now would be ultimately leading to a fair value on deferred tax assets, to a fair value on other liabilities, because if you go down the route and go until surplus, which is the last line that policyholders participate in some countries, you need to fair value each individual line item from start to finish in your balance sheet. That's fine. That would be a solution to get rid of the accounting mismatch. We are only talking accounting mismatch here.
And I think we're working overtime trying to get rid of accounting mismatches.
Okay.
It's at this stage, it's hard to add anything to the discussion. I think the stress points have been identified clearly. I think it's a question of, as Matthias said, whether or not you want to live with an accounting mismatch or not. I support the staff's recommendation, and the reason I did so was for the rationale discussed in paragraph 36, among other reasons. And here, the staff acknowledged the fact that, you know, this approach obviously is not going to result in the true estimate in accordance with the fulfillment model. However, one of the things, I guess, I took kind of a practical approach to this and thought that if the liability is more or less based on performance today, you're essentially going to true up that liability the following year. So, I mean, to the extent that there is a misstatement, the performance ultimately for the following year will bring that in line with what is actually contractually, and you can solve the difference between the amount at which it's recorded at and what it actually we paid out cash flow amount through disclosure reconciliation, if you will, of the policyholder dividend. So I can live with this because it does solve an issue, which I think is a valid issue to solve.
Steve?
But what suggestions, what proposals by the staff are you supporting? I'm not quite sure.
That supports the staff recommendation, Tatsumi.
Yeah, I said that I support the staff's recommendation, Tatsumi, and as I
in
said,
paragraph 49?
Every one of them.
Every one of them.
Yeah, across the board, right.
Oh, okay, you are not my friend.
Oh, my.
Tatsumi, you're not like my friend user. Either, because I support the staff recommendation as well, I think. I mean, clearly, ideally, we'd have all the assets at fair value and we'd measure the liability based on that, adjusting for the value of guarantees and the asymmetric features and all the rest of it. But we can't do that, as we know, deferred tax, owned property, treasury shares, owned debt. We could fiddle for some of those things to get to the right answer, but we can't fiddle all of them. And sure, we could rely on the fair value option for those financial assets, which are held at amortized costs. But I think what you're proposing is an elegant way of solving the problem. I don't see that you're lacking information. I think there'll be the fair value information in the notes anyway for the assets which are at amortized cost. People have talked about the building block approach in this area. I've always felt that describing the liability measurement in these situations as a building block approach was the wrong thing anyway, because I just don't think it fits in. If a liability is tied to some specific assets, the value of the liability has to equal the value of those assets. That's it. And there's no need to go through any building block type process to work out the value of the liability. You don't need to forecast the cash flows. You don't need to discount. You don't need to work out a risk adjustment. It's just the value of the assets. So if the value of the liability equals the value of the assets, I see no reason why book value of the liability shouldn't equal book value of the assets with adjustment for the fair value for the options and guarantees and the other things. Where I have some difficulty is clearly, the value of the options and guarantees has to be based upon fair value, and then you're combining a fair value adjustment for something which is a mixed measure. So that sort of grates a little bit. But as I said, the perfect solution would be fair value for everything. We can't get there. So I think this is a very elegant solution to the problem that we have.
Would you support the discussion?
So, Steve?
Yeah, I think we need some... we need to think about the disclosures.
So, Steve.
But, okay, carry on. I've got one question, though, for the start.
No, I think I understand your logic. Your logic is based on not because you are not able to find the fair values, but you will have all these gnarly issues like treasury stock and own property. So you're saying that because of that, rather than touching all those things, let us leave liability equal to the carrying value of the asset, measurement basis of the asset. It's not because we cannot find out the fair values, because that will create problems like I've been harping. You cannot, how can you value the fair value of the put option? Mm-hmm. So your thing is that don't touch other areas of the accounting. That's the reason.
Yeah. But my question for the staff is, presumably you've tested this to a certain extent with our constituents, and have you identified any practical problems? PK's raised one, and just wondered if you've encountered that or have talked about that with people, and are there other problems that you've identified?
I guess because PK's problem may be a theoretically good problem, but not one that I found in practice, that was not raised. In fact, this type of accounting is actually how these contracts or these features in the contracts are accounted for under current U.S. GAAP. So this is how they account for it as of now. They don't have issues with that. And I reached out to some preparers that told me that this is what they think is a sensible way of doing it.
Could I also add that we have brought a paper based on this to the working group on Monday, so we'll get some feedback then about what they think about it.
David, I'm still waiting for my turn.
I thought you'd had it, Tassimi. You've lost all your friends here, is that what you want to say?
Can I say something?
Yes, please.
Right, so regarding the paragraph 49, question 3, I have a question why staff is recommended the some change in contract liability should be put in OCI in order to match the something the asset side which is recognized in OCI. I think that what you are proposing is that in substance it's a recycling. So why you propose the recycling in here?
To me, I don't think it is proposing recycling. It is showing that if somebody else participates in the performance of an asset that is carried that is run through OCI, that participation in that share is also shown in OCI. Because if not, we would have a problem in the P&L if you don't do that.
But as a result, I think that in equity, so for example, asset is a sort of the strategic investment, and the change in strategic investment fair value should be recognized as OCI. On the face of statement of comprehensive income, it should be OCI, and also the change in the OCI should be recognized as part of equity, but say by doing by say recognizing the some change of the insurance liabilities put in OCI, so OCI in equity becomes zero. It if I understand the journal entry correctly, so eventually the in equity, OCI balance becomes zero, and that means that in substance, what is done is a sort of recycling of the strategic investment change recognized as OCI is now recognized part of the retained earnings. That means my term is in substance, it's a recycling.
That's to me, I don't think so. It is like think about the 90% share that you have in that to the policyholder. You only record the 10% that belong to the insurer. You still record in OCI and it's not recycled.
Yes.
No. Will not be recycled.
No. So
there's no recycling in that.
But say, to put the change in say change in insurance liabilities in on the face of the income statement as OCI, so it's a presentation matter, but say as a result in equity, I think that OCI balance in equity might be affected. I think it's the effect of the recycling, it seems to me.
No, I don't agree with that, Tatsumi. I think if you take the 90% case, if you didn't accept the recommendation here, what you would show is the 100% going through OCI,
yes.
And you'd show 90% going through P&L, the policyholder's 90% share going through P&L. If you accept the recommendation here, you'd show 100% credit going through OCI for the total, and you'd show 90% debit going through OCI for the policyholder's share of it.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Let's say... what I'm talking about is that 90% is, in case of 100, if no recycling, 100 should be recognized as part of OCI in equity, but say by doing the recycling, it becomes 10, and 90 is offset. In substance, it's all offset.
We can help with Tatsumi with general entry.
Okay, yeah. Can we take this offline, Tatsumi? I don't think it is recycling, but yeah, it's offsetting. That's it. Okay. Leslie, if you're still awake in America, would you like to have first go, or if you want more discussion?
Yes, thanks. Tom?
I'm growing to believe that we're over-engineering this to a significant extent, or only maybe a minor extent. Are we trying to get the liability measurement correct, the equity measurement correct, or both? I think that's a fundamental issue here. And I think the first thing that we ought to think about is, first, let's get the liability measurement correct. And I think what would be very fair to say is that when you pick the cash flows in the current measure of the building block that is owed today, the cash flows should be defined based on whatever the measurement attribute is for the assets whose performance defined the return in that setting. And that's not even talking about changing an asset measurement at all. So if we go to the example in on the top of page 10 in paragraph 25, if what the cash flows owed to the policyholder were in that instance not based on fair value, but based on 90% of the change in an amortized cost amount, I think no matter what in the building blocks approach, the current measure of the cash flows owed would be 90% of the change in the amortized cost amount. And we just make that clear. And that doesn't matter whether the assets are measured at amortized cost in the balance sheet, if we're trying to get the liability right, or at fair value in the balance sheet, if we're trying to get the liability right. The cash flows owed currently related to change in performance in this contract are defined by the change in value as to how we're measured.
Well, so let's have it right here because there's confusion. I think what you're saying is based on what you promised the policyholder.
Correct.
Right. So you used the term measurement attribute, which sounds like an accounting concept.
Yes.
And that's why I heard Larry saying that that's what the proposal is. The proposal is track an accounting concept, and I think difference.
Well, I'm assuming that the accounting... Okay, I misunderstood then. I thought the proposal said that as long as the accounting attribute match what would pay out.
I don't think we even have to get in an asset liability matching here yet. If we only want to measure the liability right, and the liability that's owed under these contracts are defined based as a percentage of change in something.
So if your accounting basis for that asset is amortized cost, but your payout is fair value,
then it should be at the fair value because you're contractually obligated to pay at the fair value. And I think what we're saying here is if you're contractually obligated to pay based on a statutory, whatever those assets are at, or if you're contractually obligated to pay and it's based on amortized costs, the liability would be what you're contractually obligated to pay based on however that
I'm just
is.
Starting if we want to get the liability right, then I'm going to move to what that means for getting equity right. So if we want to get the liability right, whatever it is, the percentage, the 20% change in an amortized cost amount or fair value amount, that's what the cash flows are under the liability. And we should say that.
Well, but in my, if you could take it to what you want to get equity right, if the amount that to be paid out is based upon the change in fair value, but yet your asset is with an amortized cost, you're going to have to do what Leslie suggested, that has changed the valuation of the asset.
Yeah, now, so that's a separate issue, but I don't think we can ever get the asset, the equity right in one sense. If the measure is based on the statutory value, we have to change the asset accounting to get to the statutory value to do that, and I don't know that we want to really do that, and I want to raise the bigger issue. Do we ever get equity right? It should be working our tail off to get equity right. Because in a mixed attribute model with many other contracts, our goal in measuring equity is never to value the whatever the distributable value of equity is. It's just a residual of assets and liabilities. So I think the goal ought to be, let's get the liability right, and that's the simple way to do that, and sort of punt on trying to get equity right, because I don't think we're ever going to get there. And that means, of the staff's proposals, in the paragraphs, on paragraph 49, proposals 1, 2, and 4 all work. But then we don't have to go through the silly thing of changing the presentation of changes into OCI or some other amount.
I don't think proposal 1, what they're proposing matches what you want.
If you reread it, it says so. If the fulfillment cash flows are based on the change in the value of an amortized cost amount or the change in the value of a fair value amount, measure the liability based on whatever the base attribute is. Regardless of how you measure assets in the statement of financial position, the real cash flows owed are the ones defined in the contract. Just base the fulfillment cash flows on the metrics defined in the contract.
So I agree with Tom. I did not read, based on this all discussion, I did not interpret the staff's recommendation to agree with Tom.
I agree with that.
So, and maybe that's part of what's written is, I mean, it's supposed to be based on, is based on what am I contractually obligated to pay? And the only, and what clouds this is I'm contractually obligated to pay whatever it is. So if it's based on a fair value, I should have my liability at a fair value. If it's based on the amortized cost, I'd have my liability at amortized cost.
For that portion.
For that portion
and
of the liability. The reason for the next part of it, even though Tom said the silliness, and if we do this in the U.S. today already, is we do go ahead and say, I base my liability on whatever I'm contractually obligated to pay. And I understand we need to clarify this for some of the concern where you might, Sam, it's at a fair value, I carried at amortized cost. I think what we're saying is that's not a realistic example from what we see, and we'd have to make sure, but it's where it's at amortized cost. I owe, you know, 90% of a $100 movement of the performance, so I owe $90. However, under U.S. GAAP, that asset is now recorded at 110, and so I own, so because that difference of 20 or that difference of the between the 100 and the 110 flows through my equity today, it is setting it aside to try to get equity right also. It's trying to get both the liability right, but then adding to the liability because you've remeasured it on a different basis and it's hitting your equity.
What my concern is about that whole thinking in three is, if it's based on a change in measure that is a statutory amount, that amount's not flowing through income anywhere. So you're not going to get that matched up in three if it's based off a statutory amount, because what's flowing through income is based on the GAAP amount. And the and actually, if I'm thinking about getting equity right, let's say the statutory amount's is an amortized cost amount, and what I've got is the fair value amount in my reporting in the statement of financial position. What is the better measure of equity available to shareholders truly is the change in the fair value amount. So I wouldn't even want to move if I wanted to get equity right. I wouldn't want to move the fair value amount of the asset back to amortized cost.
And that's not what we're recommending here at all.
But I think three is over-engineered because you can't get it matched up if the statutory amount's defining what you owed in the liability. Because the statutory amount's never flowing through income for reporting purposes. And so it's over-engineered and it gets too complicated.
I think I'm hearing you agree with John. Get the liability and don't worry about it.
They can't hear you.
Well, I guess my reaction to this conversation is I wonder if this is just an overreaction to the words in the building blocks or the way people interpreted the building blocks. I mean, if we accept the premise that the liability should be a current estimate of what you've promised to the policyholder, then to the extent that what you promised the policyholder is based on the current value of something, the liability should reflect that. Now, you may have an accounting mismatch there, and then we can consider whether we need to tinker with the whatever you linked it to. But if your liability was based on reported GAAP results or reported stat results, your liability should reflect that as well. Then I don't think we have anything to do on the other side. You've either got your GAAP the way it is, or stat is something I'm not going to tinker with. In other words, I'm not going to attempt to bridge the two because you can't. I think that was Tom's point. What I don't want to do is inadvertently create an amortized cost option, which is what John was saying. And so, sorry, John, for, you know, there was something about the way this memo was written that led us to think that that's what you were recommending. If you're saying that's not what you're recommending, that's fine. I'm going to just want to make sure that the words convey that.
And I don't think that...
I agree with you 100%. That's what I was exactly trying to say.
And then also to clarify, we're not in this memo recommending that you would change the value of the assets or changing the value. It's just, what is that additional, or you're not changing the value of any of the assets that you're actually carrying on your financial statement. This is all the determination of what this dividend piece I'm giving to the policyholder. So what is my liability, that amount of the liability? And so it goes back to the contractual amounts.
I think what you said is totally consistent with what Stephen Cooper said, except he took issue with people describing it as a building blocks approach. But I think that the way you articulate it is exactly how I would have applied the building blocks approach.
That's what I was trying to say.
Okay. Does anyone have a different view or an additional view here? Yeah. Matthias, do you think you can work with that? Do you think what I said is different from what you intended?
It is.
Yes.
Yeah.
This tries to deal with the accounting mismatch also.
Well, I think the accounting mismatch, to follow on what Leslie said, what she said better, what I was saying, is a different issue. And we can decide what to do about the accounting mismatch. Like Warren said, I think we could... In IFRS, they could decide to say for some of those assets that are at amortized cost on the balance sheet, they could try to fair value them.
Well, so I feel like the point that's been made a few times that what we could do is require fair value for everything, I don't see how that solves the problem because that doesn't seem to be what's been promised to the policy.
Correct.
I think what we're struggling with is, and the difference between what Matthias has said and what you have said, is I think what you're focusing on, and I agree with what you're focusing on, is let's get the measurement of liability correct. Then we can determine what other things we need to change to get equity as close as what we want. What Matthias has done is he's kind of combined the two and said, I want to get equity as close as I can, and I'm going to tie the measurement of liability to the asset. So those seem to be the two alternatives that we ought to vote on. Which is your one you want to get closer, liabilities or equity? And I think what you're saying is you want to get liability as close as possible, and I agree with that.
And that's what I'm saying, too. And I'm saying I don't think we can get equity right. First of all, we don't have that objective. And it's a far bigger issue than just these contracts, because if you've got more contracts out there, it's an asset liability matching across the whole balance sheet that we have to be concerned about.
In
not
industry.
Yeah.
But you're working in an industry that's driven off of capital, off of equity. And if we're not going to get that right, why are we bothered?
Well, the regulators frequently determine that capital is going to be based on something other than GAAP.
Yeah,
so that's not my objective.
I understand, but I'm thinking about all those investors out there looking at GAAP equity as a starting point. Now you're going to cause them to have to go and figure out what differences do I have to adjust this by to assess growth opportunities. You just made a challenge.
If we get the liability right and we get the asset right, we've gotten equity right.
Yes, if you get both of those.
Well, for these kinds of...
That's an axiom.
Well, we've gotten equity closer. The deferred tax is a good point. We don't, unless we're going to fair value deferred taxes, we're never going to get equity pure.
Why do you have to fair value deferred taxes?
If your ultimate contractual obligation is based on surplus, you might have to reflect deferred taxes at something other than what you reflect today. That's Matthias' point.
Yeah.
That's why he wants to tie the liability to the asset side.
Well, the problem
so he gets equity closer.
Right.
The problem with deferred taxes, if it's going to fair value, is we don't discount it. That's the problem. You measure the cash flow difference.
Okay. So I guess let me bring that to a close here. Do people agree with the way the issue's been framed? Do you want to get the liability rate, or do you want to start with trying to get equity rate?
Leslie, could I just check my understanding of what you said? And could I do it by looking at the precedent that's quoted in paragraphs 37 and 38, which is the indemnification asset in business combination? Are you saying that get the liability rights is measure the indemnification asset at fair value, regardless of the fact that the thing it's indemnifying might be on a different basis? Have I understood that correctly?
No. What I believe we meant in that guidance was that you have some exposure. Measure the exposure under, presumably for us it would be FAS 5 or for you it would be IS 37. That gap says go ahead and measure the asset to mirror the liability. But you start with the liability.
And in this case we're saying measure the liability based on the measurement of the asset that defines the liability.
So arguably your vision is more consistent with what we have in the business combination.
Right.
Measure the liability first under the appropriate measurement attribute for the liability, then deal with what you want the associated assets to be. Don't measure the liability based on what happens to be the current measurement attribute of the associated assets.
And it's a two-step process. What this was trying to do.
Oh,
the second step.
That's where I think the confusion is coming. I think we want it to be a two-step. I think Matthias is saying it's a one-step. I think the other proposal is a one-step.
Are you saying, Russ, that if this was a liability, and let's say it's based on a property portfolio, and that portfolio is held at cost, and yet the liability should say that you get the payout based on the fair value of those assets, you would propose that you revalue all these fixed assets?
I would propose that the liability reflect the actual contractual amount, which is based on fair value, and then I'd like to consider, subsequent to completion of our investment property project, if we need to make other amendments so that I can deal with the accounting mismatch. So eventually, I'd like to get those properties at more of a fair value, David. What I'm afraid is the proposal says, since the assets are at cost, the liability is at cost.
Right.
Yep.
This is what it says.
It has the potential of the tail wagging the dog, because the way we would rate that in a standard, we might have a couple of these examples in mind, but it has the potential to apply to anything that's carried at cost.
Let's get the liability right.
It's a potential link.
Sorry?
Basically what we're seeing in the proposals is that if your obligation is to hand over effectively an asset or the value of the asset, then you measure the liability at what it is, at the book value of what it is you are effectively handing over.
Mm-hmm. Factually, are you required to hold the asset? B,
we're not saying
must you necessarily hand it over?
I think we're confusing it.
Required to hold the asset, isn't it derivative?
You're not handing over the asset, and you're not handing over the base original measurement amount of the asset. What you're handing over is a percentage of a change in a value. So just measure the liability based on the change in the value that defines your obligation. And we can worry about asset measurement at another time, because the contract isn't about the original asset value, it's about changes.
And I think we can pull together some example that would show exactly how this works and how it works today in the U.S. and how it's getting at a lot of what's being said in the two-step process.
Okay, so just in the interest of bringing this to a close, who here supports the staff recommendation, which I'm going to describe as the one-step approach?
You're not asking me for a
No? What's the matter?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Oh, okay. We don't have anyone supporting that here. I guess then can I say who would support an approach that would say have the liability be a current estimate of the cash flows that have been promised to the policyholder, irrespective of how you might be accounting for the asset? That's seven. And then do people believe that in this standard, in this project, we would need to then specify how you deal with accounting mismatches between the asset and whatever the liability measurement ends up being?
I would not have a problem doing that if we think we can come to a reasonable solution fairly quickly.
Right.
I echo Hal's concerns.
Could we potentially do something like was done in BizCom?
We can pull something back together. So if we can say we'll bring something back on that second piece, because exactly what you're saying, and it doesn't come out in the paper, is what we do today. Is more a two-step approach of get your asset, get your liability right based on what you're contractually obligated to do, and then what we do is we then say, okay, however, I might carry it in a different basis. How do I deal with the accounting mismatch? So we can
I'm fully behind doing that, but it isn't just about these contracts if we're going to do it right.
Fair.
It's about all asset accounting for all, in the insurance industry if we're going to get equity right.
Okay, but we could start with participating contracts, which are linked.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Okay. So we are inclined to pursue something like that. Okay, back to you.
Leslie, can I just understand what are you going to do on the asset side now? You're voting for the liability to be whatever it is, and let's say it's based on the fair value of an asset that's carried at amortized cost. What do you intend to do about the asset side now? Because this paper was about the mismatch, wasn't it?
Right. David, we didn't land specifically on an approach, but we were basically saying perhaps what we could do is reverse the focus here and say in those cases where you end up with an accounting mismatch on a linked contract, maybe you would do something like what we did in business combinations and say, go ahead and adjust the accounting for the asset now to reflect the measurement of the liability. But I think that's a pretty narrow set of circumstances. But at any rate, we aren't finished on that piece, but we want to anchor it on the
line. I guess it's exactly the other way around in this case, and I think if you look at what you've done at business combination, it's exactly the inverse question, because there and the analogy works up to the point where you have an asset versus a liability. If you just switch from asset to liability here and try to measure the liability, the indemnification liability that you have to pay out, you can substitute everything that you read in business combination to what is in this paper.
Yeah. Yes.
I'm not sure what you're saying.
So instead of saying, if I were to read 37, you would say accounting for an indemnification liability, when a liability represents an indemnification related to a specific asset, the acquiree, I guess, should recognize and measure that indemnification liability on the same basis as that specific asset. That's mm-hmm. what the paper says.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I thought the accounting in that standard was, I did a business combination, someone indemnified me, how do I account for the asset? But we can take that offline.
Yeah, they indemnify me for my other indemnification. That's why you mirror the two.
I think if we went the way that the staff proposed here, basing the liability based on whatever measurement attribute was in the accounting model, we would mismeasure the liability because it would end up having a change in asset basis, defining a liability that is different from the contractual cash flows in some instances. And that's just a mismeasurement of the liability.
Why don't we find what the ISB is, and then if we need to reconcile it, maybe we can do it next week.
Okay, can we ask the vote here? Who would support the staff recommendation? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. Against?
David, can you hear me?
Yes, Pat?
I'm against the staff recommendation.
Okay. Tatsumi, what was your vote?
I'm abstained.
Okay, so that was 9-4.
I'd like to clarify the question 1 and 3.
Not now, you won't, Tatsumi. It's We were 9-4 in favor of the staff recommendation. So it's, I think in Hal's words, we were trying to get the equity more balanced as opposed to getting the liability. Yeah, Warren?
I said before, I think there's two additional things that I'd like to see happen if we go down this path. One is disclosures, which we'll come back to. And secondly, I don't see that if we agree to support the staff recommendation, I don't see that means we shouldn't proceed with the proposal in the exposure draft to provide an option in relation to owner-occupied properties and treasury shares for those to be at fair value. Just so that's on the record.
Do you want to vote that one?
We should put that to the vote, I think.
Would the board agree with that?
Yes.
Anyone disagree?
I disagree. I don't support options.
Okay, that's two disagree. Okay, so you may end up with the same answer. Some countries may not be able to value these things. That's part of the problem you've got. But then why did they give the option to have a participating contract, if that's the case? Okay. Any other damage we can do, Andrea?
I think you've done very well. But the damage.
So now can I clarify one thing?
Okay, some people have to go, but carry on.
Okay, so the conclusions reached by the ISB and the FASB is totally the opposite direction?
Yeah.
Yes.
It seems that way.
Okay. Okay, yeah. Thank you.
Katsumi, we are your friend.
That's right.
Okay, thanks, Lacey. I think we're done.
Okay. Alrighty, we'll see you next week.
Thank you. Good night.
Good night.
I know, guys. Why don't we come back at 6:15?